the moon and back. And so you start coming up with numbers like one photon of energy per second is coming back into the receiver, which I think comes out to be minus 220 dBm, as I remember. Could you and I design a receiver that can listen to a signal of minus 220 dBm, approximately one photon per second? Well, it turns out, let me drop it. The scientists at the European Southern Observatory decided to take their biggest dual telescope, which I think is 8 meters in diameter for each mirror, and they're using both mirrors simultaneously, aimed at the Halley's Comet, while it's at aphelion. It's out there at the peak of its distance from the sun. It's a 29th magnitude signal. And so the signal they're getting, the solar reflection off of this piece of coal called Halley's Comet at maximum range, represents a signal strength of roughly one photon per second in this pair of dishes 8 meters in diameter collecting the signal. They had to do a couple of fancy things to get rid of the background noise, but they managed to measure the solar energy reflected off Halley's Comet at maximum range. So measuring one photon per second, at least at optical frequencies, it appears as though it has been done. Therefore, it suggests we can do it at radio frequencies. There may not be a limit to how weak a signal could be. Could they also make a measurement of a tenth of a photon per second? I think the answer is yes. AC2GS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, I think, I believe they could, but you'd have to increase the sampling rate, because you can't detect half of a photon or a quarter of a photon or three quarters of a photon. It was a very weird experiment where they actually tried to generate a pulse of light that was less than a full cycle wavelength in duration, to see what the heck would happen if you tried to do that. And they somehow were able to kind of probability squeeze it out 50% of the time. If they tried to generate a half wavelength pulse of a given light wavelength, half the time they would get the pulse and half of the time they would get nothing. So quantum mechanics is weird.
Okay, that tenth of a photon, let me drop it. If I'm receiving a signal of a tenth of a photon per second, and if I'm integrating considerably longer than 10 seconds, on average, I will be getting one photon per 10 seconds. So if my noise equivalent bandwidth of my receiving device is narrow enough, if my integration time is long enough, I think there's nothing stopping you from measuring of a fraction of a photon per second, but you're doing it for a very large number of seconds. So we can trade off bandwidth, time, noise equivalent bandwidth, noise figure, aperture size. We can trade off all these numbers. And when you do it with enough skill, I don't think there's a limit. I think a tenth of a photon per second is a detectable signal on reception. And now, can you transmit a tenth of a photon? That's a tough one. If I start transmitting a photon at a particular wavelength, and I cut off the generator before it has completed one cycle, frequency is defined as the rate of change of phase. During the time the transmitter is on, I still have that particular rate of change of phase. I have generated that particular frequency, with a hell of a lot of bandwidth through it, of course, and so that really constitutes a smaller amount of amplitude, because I didn't wait for the sine wave to come up to full amplitude. It's just another way of attenuating the signal when if I transmit a fraction of the signal's sine wave, a fraction of its second. I still think that's a something that can be done. If I can do it on reception, I think I can do it on transmission. AC2GS, K2RIW in the deck net.
I tend to think that the problem is that if you try and generate fractions of a photon, you won't be able to propagate anything, or it will be probabilistic. So like I said, they generated a pulse that was the equivalent of half of a wavelength, and half of the time it produced a propagating wave, and the other half of the time it didn't. And, you know, let's take it to the most absurd. Say it's a tenth of a photon per billion years. years. Yeah, I guess if you could build a machine that lasted a lot longer than the universe has been around, you could do that. But it becomes a practical impossibility.
I don't think I agree. Without a doubt, as you make the signal weaker and weaker, it becomes more and more difficult. You have to integrate for a longer and longer period of time. You have to use more and more crafty techniques to get rid of the background noise and the Johnson noise and so on. But with a narrow enough bandwidth and a long enough integration time, I don't think there's a limit. I'll admit there's a limit to practicality. Like you said, you're not going to integrate for half the length of the universe time. So in that respect, there is a practical limit. But in theory, I don't think there is a limit. When I propose to build a radar at 10 gigahertz, where each individual pulse was a quarter of a nanosecond. Each individual pulse was 2.5 cycles at 10 gigahertz. People told me you can't possibly do that. Well, with a broadband doubly balanced mixer used as an on-off switch, it did the job beautifully. And I discovered by experimental techniques that it wasn't a rectangular pulse that I was generating. I was generating a triangular pulse. So the 2.5 cycles of the pulse, it had a rise time on the beginning and a fall time on the end of the pulse, if you know what I mean. It drew a triangular envelope. And I made sure that the individual pulses were not in any way synchronized to the RF cycle. Therefore, a million pulses per second, a quarter of a nanosecond per pulse, where each pulse was non-synchronous in envelope, when you displayed that on a sampling oscilloscope, it gave you a beautiful envelope of the pulse wave form, the triangular shape of the pulse, and inside of the triangular pulse was a whole bunch of incoherent dots, and all those dots represented the energy of a million of those pulses. Worked like a charm. That was an X-band radar that had a third of a foot of range resolution, and I used it inside of that 300-foot chamber out of Edwards Air Force Base, and it allowed us to find all of the undesired phony echoing devices that are inside of that anechoic chamber. So fractions of a cycle, so to speak, as I see it, are doable, Roy. I didn't say it's easy, but I think it's doable. I think Mother Nature will let you do that. So a fraction of a photon per second, and by the way, what's magic about a second? A photon per second versus two photons per 2 seconds? Or a photon per 10 seconds? What's magic about a second? Why does a photon per second seem to be a mental limit to you and I? AC2GS, K2LIW?
WB3SWW with a question.
Yes. I think it's, you know, there's a big difference between technical difficulty and practicality. I mean, yes, again, I have no problem with one photon per hour or one photon per day or even one photon per year. But when you start to get to one photon per billion years, it becomes so impractical that it's theory is great. I love theory. I love theory as much as the next guy, but the practicality trumps theory. I mean, there are things that are theoretical that don't seem to work out in practical terms. There's something called the Planck's constant, which is the minimum calculatable thing that an object can have. And the Planck's constant for charge in coulombs is actually larger than the charge an electron itself has, so it violates that theory. There's a good reason why it violates that theory, because the model is off, and it's assuming a spherical charge when it's a non-dimensional charge. But, you know, I mean, sometimes an impracticality becomes an impossibility.
So I have a problem with it, one photon per second. See, the thing is that I do not understand how in an anechoic chamber you were able to achieve, say, less photons per unit time. You have a photon pile-up when two or more photons interact in the same detection cell. So how do you prevent other photons to interact with whatever is the destination for the photon and to achieve?
That measurement that was made by the European Southern Observatory, those were not 1 second exposures. They were receiving a signal strength of the solar echo from Halley's Comet, 10 to the minus 29, the 29th magnitude, solar magnitude, or astronomical magnitude, and it was approximately one photon per second, but each one of those photographs was multiple minutes of integration time per photograph, and a whole bunch of them were stacked on top of each other to average a result. So with enough integration factor, you're really measuring a larger number of photons. You're not measuring only for 1 second. So by the same token, if I'm measuring the super weak signal coming back from the moon at 10 gigahertz, I don't have to make a decision in 1 second as to whether or not the signal is there. And so as long as I'm talking about reasonable integration times, 1 second, 10 seconds, 1 minute, 10 minutes, 1 hour, you and I can do that. If it starts coming up to an integration time of a year, I don't believe it anymore. My instrumentation is not going to be well calibrated for that length of time. It's going to be drifting and making other sources of noise and whatever. So if I calculate that I need a century of integration time, yes, without changing something else to make it a lot easier, we're not going to do that. But if I had to integrate a signal for 1 hour in order to make a 98% probability accuracy of whether or not a signal was there, I don't think you and I would object to a 1 hour integration time. And maybe that's sort of the limit. AC2GS, K2RIW, what do you think, Roy?
No, I agree entirely with you, Dick. It's a matter of the practicality and the instrumentation, and it is not bizarre to believe that at some point the instrumentation will allow a century-long scanning for photons. But again, when you start to work at time frames that are the lifetime of the universe, it becomes ultimately impractical to the point of absurd. You know, nothing... No intelligent life form is going to spend the entire lifetime of the universe doing any measurement. So although theoretically there's a theoretical possibility, in the practical universe that we exist in, it's not.
I guarantee that if anybody in 1977, when Voyager was launched, somebody said, hey, I guess that we're going to measure the absolute limit of the solar wind of this sun, we're going to measure the limit of this particular solar system, we're going to go outside of that limit and measure the galactic wind, and we're going to make that measurement from 13 million miles away, 40 years downrange, on this particular 10-watt traveling wave tube operating at 8.5 gigahertz off of a nuclear power supply. And that signal at 8.5 gigs is going to go into a 12-foot diameter dish that I'm going to aim at the Earth to the nearest plus or minus a tenth of a degree in azimuth and a tenth of a degree in elevation. I'm going to have that degree of aiming accuracy 40 years downrange. If anybody had made those statements in 1977, any sane person you and I know, Roy, would say, what in the world are you guys smoking? Where did you buy it? They did that. And those guys had enough foresight and designed the hardware to have that capability to do what was supposed to be a two-planet flyby of Jupiter and Saturn. Let me drop. And because they realized that once per 176 years you get this favorable alignment of the outer four planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, and that they could do a flyby of all four of them in sequence, and even though they could only talk Richard Nixon into funding the first two planets, Jupiter and Saturn, of the flyby, they could only talk them into funding that much of it, but they planned for the rest of it, assuming that somebody would give them funding for the rest. That's one hell of a project. As you can tell, there was a PBS special about Voyager over the last couple of weeks. It's very good. I know that Howie wants to ask us a question about all of this. To the B2HWW, there's a guy who can listen to weak signals. K2RIW, go ahead, Howie.
Yeah, the question that I want to ask, Dick, let's say you were running 100 watts or 500 watts, let's say either on 144 or 432, either CW, you had the narrowest receiver, You're not talking about moon belts. Either you're running verticals or horizontal beams. Could you theoretically hear that signal in Europe or 8,000 miles away or 5,000 or out, or let's say on the other side of the planet, knowing that these signals only travel in line of sight? That's my question. You say your signal goes everywhere, and I understand that, and I agree with you. But let's say we have the most narrowest receiver, we're going to run the slowest CW, or we're going to use some kind of digital mode running, let's say, either 100 or 500 watts, you know, not a kilowatt, not millions of watts. Could we hear that signal 8,000 miles away on a VHF signal of frequency like 144 or 432 or even 1,200 megs? That's my question. Could it practically be done?
And the answer is absolutely yes. If you take a look at the 1967 issue of IEEE Proceedings, there was a series of articles of over-the-horizon propagation at 440 megahertz. They used the 120-foot-wide billboard antenna at the Round Hill, Massachusetts, aimed it down the East Coast to a similar antenna in North Carolina, as I remember. I think the total distance was something like 800 miles, and they measured signal strength using a couple of kilowatt transmitter. Because of over-the-horizon propagation through this atmosphere, the atmosphere always gives you forward-propagated tropospheric propagation. In other words, you always have atmospheric inhomogeneity. There's always little bitty hot spots and cold spots of the air rising in the atmosphere. The radio signal hitting those chunks of atmosphere get deflected over the horizon. So when you look at their graph of signal strength versus distance, it has a fall off of a known number of dB per mile, so to speak. And the dBs per mile become smaller and smaller numbers as the miles become larger and larger. So there is, by way of forward-propagated tropospheric propagation, there is a predictable amount of signal that gets over that horizon. Let me drop. I used that phenomenon for four solid years while talking to K4CAW on 432 on 480 megacycles. He was in Greensboro, North Carolina, 480 miles. My radio horizon is 60 miles in front of my antenna. I talked to a guy at 480 miles on 432, day in and day out, by using a 29 dB gain antenna on my end, and he had about a 22 dB gain antenna on his end. Good receivers, good transmitters, and we did it every Tuesday from 7:30 to 8 o'clock for a solid 4 years. We just couldn't believe that signal would get there, summer, winter, spring, and fall. So over the horizon, by knife-edge deflection off of mountains, by atmospheric inhomogeneity, there is a predictable amount of signal versus range. So if you've got the right amount of transmitting equipment, the right amount of transmitting equipment antenna area, right amount of receiving equipment receiving antenna, right amount of receiving equipment sensitivity, the right amount of bandwidth, can you talk around the world on 432 by a predictable number of dB? The answer is yes. I didn't say it's easy. I didn't say anyone has done it yet. But they have talked 800 and some odd miles in that experiment, which you can read about, as I said, in an issue of IEEE Proceedings, somewhere around 1967. They were talking about the experiments for long-range tropo propagation with high reliability. Over to you, Howie. WB2HWW, K2IW in the TechNet.
That seems reasonable. I've already worked North Carolina, and I've worked into, I've put Florida on VHF, scatter or something, or even, or tropo. I put a single 500-700 miles. But what I'm talking about, could you talk from here to Europe on VHF without using moon belts? Do you think anyone has done it? Is it theoretically possible? You are saying it's theoretically possible. But I know there are guys now that are using this, FT8 on 6 meters, and they're talking to guys in Europe. Now, I can see that happening on 6 meters, because 6 meters has E-skip or double hop or even F-skip. But let's say getting to 432 or something, you think it's theoretically possible with practical equipment to hear a signal from Europe other than moon bound?
Yes, I do. And now, you and I can always talk about when you get a band opening by way of sporadic E and other kinds of crazy propagation where the sun gives you a burst of particles or whatever. You and I are talking about reliable communication. If you've got the right equipment, can you talk on 432 across the big pond, the Atlantic Ocean? I know the answer is yes. I didn't say it's easy. I know that there's an experiment that's been going on for some period of time where they've got a beacon transmitter in Nova Scotia with a high-gain 2-meter Yagi aimed at Europe. And I think they've made it one way on a couple of occasions. I don't think they've made it two ways. So 2 meters across the Atlantic Ocean, I'm convinced it's doable without a sporadic E band opening. By that token, also at Palos Verdes, California, over to Hawaii, a 2,200-mile path. Can't think of the guy's call letters right now. He's a silent key. Way back in the early 70s, late 60s, he did it. There was a guy in Palos Verdes with a 28-foot diameter parabolic dish. Let me drop it. And a similar dish on the Big Island of Hawaii, 2,200 miles. They talked to each other on 2 meters, 432, and they were starting to do it on 1296. I'll admit that what's going on in that particular case is there's a particular kind of weather condition you get in the Pacific Ocean in late August almost every year for about 1 week where that path does open up. But forward propagated tropospheric scatter has a very predictable amount of fall off of dB per miles, even though we're talking about way beyond the radio horizon, Earth curvature, if you know what I mean. That signal goes everywhere. In free space, it easily goes an infinite number of miles. Around the Earth, it's a little bit more complicated. You're now talking about the random statistics of our atmosphere and other weather conditions. I think it's time we go over to the space report. And I think it's now 667 days that the astronaut, the lady astronaut, who's 57 years old, just came back down. Paul, WS2N, K2RIW and TechNet, you've got a Paul.
This is WS2N, yeah, Peggy Whitson came back successfully on the Soyuz spacecraft. And yeah, collectively, that's how many days, but this time around it was 10 months. It was supposed to be shorter than that. She was supposed to come back in June, but due to the Russians cutting back on the amount of people that they want up there for themselves, because, you know, they used to like to have two or three, and now they're down to just the two. So they sent up a Soyuz spacecraft, a while back with just two people on it. The cosmonaut was the commander, and then Jack Fisher, the American. So that left an empty seat. So first Peggy was supposed to come back earlier, and they figured, well, we'll don't leave her, and she's going to come back with that group, and she waited all the way till now. That gave her 10 months of dropping. So, and also about, I think it's 10 EVAs, so she's got more EVAs than anybody else, too. So she set all kinds of records. And yeah, that's her age, 57. So, came back with Jack Fisher. K2FSH is Jack's call. He's the fellow that the astronaut that was on board the International Space Station through Ares spoke to the school here in Rock Hockham, if I may, that had 12 of their students ask questions. 20 questions were asked, and all 20 were answered and, by Jack Fisher, and that, excuse me, about a 12-minute pass So that was really good. So I'm glad to see him get back. I know the students here were paying attention even though it's summertime, making sure he got back safe. And of course, the commander, Russian commander, also returned. Let me drop it. This is WS2M. His name is Fyodor Yuchinkin, and he's got some kind of a record up there, too. He's been up there forever, many, many times. This was his fifth flight, so very successful. They landed, very soft landing, after a very smooth departure from the space station. This happened last night. I was able to watch it on NASA TV, and they undocked from the space station. Everything went fine. They left three people on board, so now there's three on board the station. And then they started the deorbit burn two orbits later. So it's roughly 3.5 hours from when they undocked to when they actually land, 3.5 to 4 hours. And then they separate the different modules on the Soyuz. You know, there's three modules. There's a propulsion module in the back, and then in the middle is the descent module, and that's also where they are located when they launch. And then the one in front of it is the orbital module, and those three pieces separate exactly at the same time, and then the descent module comes back with those three people on board. They have a drogue parachute that pulls out the big, I think it's a 1,000-square-foot parachute that opens up. That brings them pretty much down. You can see the parachute, you know, very good picture, very clear day. The heat shield then separates pretty high up, quite a few miles up that separates, and then that allows the altimeter and radar to look at the ground and give them accurate readings. Because right before they hit the ground in Kazakhstan, four solid boosted rockets fire only for a split second, and that's to slow them down that little extra bit that they require right at the end to have somewhat of a soft landing. The commander did say it felt like a soft landing, and he should know. He's been up and down quite a few times. So is Peggy, and she had a rough landing one time. So they did say it was a very good landing. Let me drop it. The Russian from Roscosmos, he flies back to Star City. They'll take him back, and then Peggy Whitson and Jack Fisher will get on board a European Space Agency plane, and they're probably home by now, and then they were flying them to Germany, Cologne, Germany, where they're going to meet up with the Gulfstream, the NASA plane, and then they were going to take them directly back to Houston. Because of the hurricane in Houston, that's fouled up NASA with the Gulfstream a little bit, so normally they would fly the Gulfstream directly, one shot right back from Kazakhstan all the way to Houston, but not this time. They employed the European Space Agency airplane to get them halfway. Let me drop it. And the next thing I was going to bring up, you pretty much caught up already, was Voyager. And the reason all this Voyager stuff is on right now is because it's the 40th anniversary. In fact, a couple of days from now, today's what, the 3rd, so the 4th, 5th, Tuesday would be the 40th anniversary of the launch of Voyager 1. Voyager 2 was launched before Voyager 1, so that's already passed by about 15 days. They are going to have a lot of interviews. Looks like a lot of people are going to be at Smithsonian discussing the Voyager missions, and that will be live on on the computer, on for me anyway, on NASA TV. That'll be 12:30 on Tuesday. And, I'm not sure how long it's going to be on for, but they have a lot of people. Probably about nine or ten people that are going to be talking about it. And one of the people is an original from the beginning of Voyager, Ed Stone. He's the project scientist for Voyager. And he'll be on. And also Anne Duran. Anne Duran is the wife of Carl Sagan. Drop it. So I'm sure they'll have some questions for how Carl Sagan was instrumental in putting that gold record on Voyager, on both Voyagers, which have all the sounds of birds, pictures of birds. It's got a needle on there to with instructions on the cover to whoever finds it a billion years from now to figure out to set the spacecraft that landed in their backyard. But the launch of Voyager 1 was September 5th, like I said before, 1977, and they launched from Launch Complex 41, and both of them went from Launch Complex 41 to Launch Voyager 2 launched first, days earlier in August, on August 20th, from Launch Complex 41, and then they had to clean up the pad, get it all ready, and then they launched the second one, and turns out that launch complex is now being used today to launch all these Atlas flights that the United Launch Alliance uses. Atlas take a lot of flights up for NASA and the government. They've even taken a couple of three Cygnus flights from Orbital ATK when Orbital ATK couldn't fly. Because they had an explosion on the pad in Wallops Island back in 2014. So United Launch Alliance, which is really a consortium of Boeing and Lockheed, they helped them out and reconfigured the Cygnus spacecraft to the top of Atlas, so they were able to make those launches. So that launch bed is still being used. And quite often, literally 70 or 80 flights by the Atlas V rocket. So that's the story on Voyager. And, many other topics here, too. Let me just go through them quick. WS. They were the main topics. Harvey Storm in Houston, Rockford, and Victoria, and Beaumont, Texas. I was in Beaumont. I can imagine that place being underwater. That sounds unbelievable. They lost all their water and everything. Well, they have water through the streets of downtown Houston. But the Johnson Space Center did stay open, and that's the mission control for all the flights of the international that go up to the International Space Station. So they're in constant contact with the space station, and they never closed for a second. So they just stayed open. That was good to hear. One other topic. Let me bring you up to date on Dream Chaser. Dream Chaser is being built by SNC, the Nevada Corporation, and they're building this space plane, originally built for astronauts, but then they got a contract with NASA to do strictly cargo flights, and in the future they will have astronauts that will be able to go on a Dream Chaser crew version of this thing, but their development is coming along. They have a Dream Chaser out in California now that they're testing. They've driven it around on the runway, 60 miles an hour, and let it go, and checking all the controls, computers, and toward the end of this month, they'll be taking up on a helicopter and dropping it. Well, for the first couple of times, they'll be probably carrying it a couple more times. They've already done that, I think, once. Where they'll carry the spacecraft up and come back down and land it. But by the end of the month, they're going to do a carry and release. And then the Dream Chaser will be landing on a runway. They tried something exactly the same thing back in 2013. They used a smaller helicopter. They have a much bigger helicopter now. It's their commercial version of a Chinook helicopter. You know, one of these helicopters with two big props on top. So that will probably happen at the end of the month. And hope that one goes successful. The one in 2013, everything went good, but they had a landing gear that they weren't even planning on using. They just temporarily used a landing gear from a fighter jet, and it collapsed on landing back in 2013, and that put them pretty far behind. It didn't really ruin the spacecraft, but they had a lot of work to do and rebuild it. That's when they switched over from, eventually a couple of years later, they switched over to going from a crewed vehicle to a cargo vehicle. And then eventually they'll go back to using their cargo, to go back to a crewed vehicle, which will be able to carry up to 7 people. So this thing is going to be able to carry most payload up to the space station when it's does go into operation. That should be at the end of 2019, the earliest, and possibly early 2020 to drop. They already have a contract for two launches with an Atlas V. They'll take the space plane, they'll put it on top of the Atlas V, encapsulated in a fairing, and they'll launch, and the fairing will separate, and the second stage will push that all the way into the space station. Because of the heavy payloads, the Atlas V will be using the most amount of solid booster rockets that they can use. They can use one, they can use two, they'll be using five, and it'll be the first time that the second stage will have two engines on board. Usually they have one Centaur engine, liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen engine. This time they'll have two on board. They're RL-10 engines made by Aerojet Rocketdyne. So they'll be using that for the first time. So they have a designation for these rockets. They usually have numbers like, 401. So 4 would be 4 meter diameter fairing on top. So, and then there's a 501, that would be a 5 meter diameter on top. Zero would stand for no booster engines. A 5 would be, 5 booster engines. And then the last number, it's always been a 1, this one Centaur engine, and this time it will be a 2, so this will be a 5-5-2 configuration for the Atlas when they finally launch Dream Chaser. In a little over 2 years, I expect that to go up. But I'll be good. Two other things. Jet Propulsion is proposing some kind of a landing vehicle that they would like to send to Venus. This is on the drawing board, but it's pretty interesting that, they plan on having a landing vehicle land and then have it powered by the wind. The wind will be able to also turn a gear, which will turn another blade, and the blade will be radar reflective. And they'll be able to send information from the surface of Venus to an orbiting spacecraft. An orbiting spacecraft will be looking down with a radar, pinging the spinning blade on the spacecraft to pick up information. Right now, the most time a spacecraft has been able to stay on Venus is roughly about a half hour. They have the Varina program and Vega programs with the Russians back in the 80s. And they didn't last too long. They would transmit information back to Earth directly with the 90 bar or 90 pounds, 90 times the amount of pressure that we have here on Earth, and 900 degrees temperature. The spacecraft that landed lasted maybe a half hour, at the most 20 minutes. They would stop functioning, so they'd get some pictures and some information back. JPL is planning on having this thing go up and be able to stay up there for a year, a month at a time, without burning up, because it won't have any real electronics that will fail on the on this thing. And also, they want to make it be able to walk, not with wheels, but walk with some kind of legs on it. And again, that would be powered by the wind. So it's a way out idea. But they have some preliminary funding. So JPL, they're the ones that come up with all these things. They're the ones involved with Voyager and Viking missions, countless other deep space missions. And this is what they wanted to devise, some kind of a walking mechanical thing that won't burn up or explode or implode on the planet of Venus. I thought that was interesting. Too many other things to go through there. I just want to mention that the end of Cassini is coming up. I know we'll have another net before that, because it's September 15th. So it's something to keep in mind. This thing has been in orbit around Saturn since 2004. Here we are all these years later, and it's still functioning. But running out of fuel, and they don't want to contaminate any nearby moons, so they'd rather burn it up in the atmosphere. And that's exactly what they did with Galileo. Galileo was orbiting Jupiter for probably 5 years or so, and they did the same thing with that. They didn't want to contaminate one of those moons, so they deorbited into the planet. And then, of course, with that dense atmosphere and going 100,000 miles an hour, every little bit is will burn up. That's it for now, Dick, unless you need more topics. This is WS2N for the Space Net Report for the TechNet. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, some darn good information there, Paul. In the case of the Soyuz spacecraft that came back and brought Peggy Whitson and two other astronauts, with her, three people were on board. I vaguely remember that Soyuz sometimes came back down with only two people on board, so I'm a little bit confused by that. Also, I saw on the news report the landing. The landing looks like it took place by way of an extremely large single parachute. The Apollo spacecraft, every time they came back, they had three separate parachutes. I'm kind of amazed that Soyuz uses one single parachute. That's a lot of eggs in one basket, if you know what I mean. It's got to work. I'm a little bit afraid there's not much of a backup on that. And when it comes to this rocket blast, just before it hits the ground to soften the landing, has Soyuz always had that from the very beginning? And if anything misfires on that, is that what constitutes a hard landing? If you don't get the rocket to retro burn just before landing? So give me a couple of answers on those, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, they've always had that. The shield comes off and then exposes four little rockets. And they go off exactly right when they land. You can see that. If you didn't know, you would think, oh no, it exploded, you know, but just see a big puff of dust come up. But yeah, that's been their system. And as far as parachutes go, you have there's one small drogue parachute I know that comes out and pulls out this big massive one. So, and then what happens is you you think, well, okay, suppose that fails. There's another big parachute inside that thing sitting there that could also come out in case that something started going wrong with that other one. So they actually use two parachutes, you know, one that's just folded up and it doesn't come out. So that's their backup system. That's never happened, no. Yeah, Apollo has had three. Dragon is supposed to have four now. You know, when they start coming back with people, they'll also have four. You see that when they bring the cargo Dragon vehicles back to the Pacific. They have, I believe they have three, and then the crewed version is going to have four. It's a different system for different people. The Starliner being built by Boeing should be operating, bringing people up to the space station a couple of months after SpaceX with their Dragon. I believe they're three. I remember, you know, I've seen the test before. They use three. They have an interesting setup, though, for Boeing. For now, Dragon will be landing in the ocean.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
SpaceX boat. Well, Boeing is going to come down. He'd shield, I believe, three parachutes. I might be wrong on that. And then, as they get very close to land, instead of having these rocket blasts, they're going to have these airbags come out. So completely surrounding the bottom of the Starliner. You know, they've run multiple tests. They can test in the water with it. I mean, it comes out like an airbag. So that's pretty interesting. And yet it's confusing with what's been going on with lately with different crews going up. Going back to the beginning, yeah, they had two. All they needed was two. They had, at the beginning of the space station, they had just the Unity module and the FGB, the functioning cargo block, they call it. Which that was the first big section from Russia. And that was bolted to our Unity module via a pressure mating adapter, PMA-1. So now you have these three pieces floating in space. So, you know, when they first sent the crew up there, all they needed was two. I mean, they were just going to work on it, stay there a very short period of time and leave. And then another crew was going to replace them with bigger modules. And eventually got bigger and bigger. And you went from a crew of two to eventually a steady crew of three. In those days, the space shuttle was coming up and going. So it was bringing up, sometimes it would go up with seven people. It would drop one off, drop two off, come back with one, come back with two. And it was a complicated scheme. The space shuttle was quite active in that. But you still had the story of the rockets going up. Most of the time they were going up with two. And they got to the point where they needed three on a regular basis. And eventually they started to send up two spacecraft, three and three. When NASA was grounded from the drop in 2003. And then they said, well, there's only going to be a certain amount of consumables on board. Let's go back to only sending up two. So the Russians started sending up two at a time. And then you only had a crew of two on the space station. As it got built, and you got all these 11 truss pieces put together and gigantic solar wings and at least 12 miles of 11 big modules, anyway, attached to the space station where you get plenty of living room. It's bigger than inside of a 747. So now you're able to support six people. So now they send them three at a time and back three at a time. And, you know, there's almost a space shuttle. It's retired as the Atlantis was last with the STS-135 flight in 2011. So now you just have the Soyuz going up for now. 2011 drop. Three at a time, screen of time. Next thing you know, one time you had six on board, and they sent another Soyuz up there. Temporarily had nine, and 2 days later, one crew went back. But generally, you always have a crew of six people, and they're usually two cosmonauts, usually a European Space Agency, usually two Americans, that type of thing. So, recently, the Russians decided we don't want to have two Russians up there. We just have one Russian up there. We don't want to pay for this anymore because we're not getting the science that we used to get out of it. We have a module that's supposed to go up in the last 10 years and it's still sitting on the ground. It's called the Nokia. Nokia is a multi-purpose module that they've had some problems with. And delay after delay after delay. Well, it's supposed to be a very large module that they were going to adapt to the Russian part of the International Space Station. They would have had a lot more room, an extra bathroom, more sleeping quarters. Well, that didn't happen. They're delaying it now. I heard 2018, the last I heard that will go up. And then they'll be happy. They'll be able to keep their go back to their regular system. So now we thought we were going to have just five up there. In fact, they went and they launched Jack Fisher, K2FSH, the astronaut that spoke to our school here in Montauk. They launched him and one Russian and an empty seat. By doing that, they had a spacecraft attached to it and they had three people on board. One of those people was Peggy Whitson. So she talked to NASA and they said, look, she wanted to stay up there. And then she got it, instead of coming back with the other crew that she went up with, they came back with two people. She came back with Jack Fisher and the commander, Yuchinkin, last night. So that's how that worked out. Now they're switching back to 3 and 3. This time, now they're going to send up, they'll probably always have two Americans. Maybe two European space agencies, maybe even three Americans. Because what they're going to do is, let me drop it. NASA wound up getting a deal from Boeing. Boeing came into, like, I don't know, $500 million at Roscosmos, which that's the NASA version for Russia, agreed to. Boeing was owed a lot of money from the Russians, $500 million or something. So they were a partnership in this sea launch system. The sea launch system, they would go out in the middle of the ocean with these rockets and launch them from the equator. And Norway was involved, Russia, and Boeing. But the system failed. They made, I don't know, 10, 12 launches, but they went belly up. And then there was lawsuits that went back internationally. We dropped it. And a year later, probably about a year and a half ago, that was all settled, and Boeing wound up with a fistful of money. And they told NASA, we'll buy you flights. We pay $70 million to Russians for every person we send up. Boeing says, we'll keep pouring money into it. We'll make sure you have enough people, another seat. Since there's an empty seat, you can fill it with, European Space Agency guy or one of our guys, whatever you want to do. So that's the present plan for the future. So you'll be seeing 3 and 3, 3 and 3. You won't see two going up and two coming back anymore. It would have been that way, but Boeing stepped in. Very confusing. I hope I explained it. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
Was the Soyuz spacecraft originally designed for three people, but for a whole lot of time we only sent two up and two back down? Or from the days when they were sending two astronauts up and now they're sending three, was that a redesign of Soyuz? How do you recall?
The initial design of Soyuz was two. but they decide, let's make it spring. So, whether they, you know, they actually did that in the beginning. A little bit with Mir. Don't forget, Mir was up for 15 years. The last 4 years or so, we started joining the Russians in the Mir project, and we started sending space shuttles up. We sent a total of 5 space shuttles up over those years. Well, you know, it was they were up for 15 years before they deorbited that in 2000. So those other previous years, they had Soyuz craft going up and down, and then, in fact, we toward the end of that mission, we would actually send up some of our Americans with the Russians. Dr. Taggart was one guy. He was the first guy to go up in a Russian spacecraft. And he went to Mir. So it's been going for a long time. So it's generally 3. But yeah, they've done 2. Back to you soon.
Dream Chaser. When you see a photograph of it by going to Wikipedia and Dream Chaser, it has a strong resemblance to the space shuttle. Except that it's got a very different launch mechanism where there's no chance of ice falling off of the launch vehicle and hitting the wings of the Dream Chaser. And Dream Chaser is going to have the capability of, I think it's 11, is it 5,000 kilograms? 11,000 pounds, I think, is the payload capability. And there's both a version which is pressurized and non-pressurized. So I presume it's going to be able to take some number of astronauts on board. How soon is the first major launch of Dream Chaser in which it will link up with the International Space Station? Is that going to take place possibly in 2018, Paul? WS2N,
K2RIW? No, that'll be 2019. Let's see. Probably toward the end of 2019, you'll see the first launch of Dream Chaser. And when it goes up, it'll be the cargo version. Cargo bay version is going to have those back wings. They're going to fold, like on hinges. And the reason they're folding is they have to be encapsulated inside this 5-meter fairing on top of the Atlas V rocket. And then once it gets to orbit, those wings will open up. And then there's also a back part. And that's like a big piece sticking out. Like a service module type of thing. Oh, that's where a lot of that extra cargo is going to be. And that's also where the solar wings are going to pop out for power. So that will be end of 2019. Now, they already have a contract with NASA for 6 flights. It's $1 billion contract. So these things are signed, ready to go. And so that's why they're really pushing this, they're being funded now by NASA to complete the Dream Chaser. So they have 6 cargo missions planned over like a 4-year period or so to the International Space Station. Of course, I believe they're going to get more contracts after that. After that period of time, after some amount of years, I'm sure they'll get a contract with NASA to go up with a crew. It won't be this vehicle. It'll be a crewed version of this vehicle. Same size, same shape. It'll be a crewed version of the Dream Chaser. That's how they started out. They've been developing this, like, I don't know, last 12, 13 years.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
On the Dream Chaser project. Let me drop it. So that's going to... that goes back a lot of years. And they were first going to make it with passengers. Like, when they're testing out California right now, it looks like it has windows. So that's the exact same thing as what they're building in the factory right now for cargo. The only difference is the cargo one has these wings that fold up. And when they go with a crewed launch, they're not going to have a... fairing, from what I understand. It's just going to be a vehicle that will sit on top of the Atlas. And it's going to make it a lot easier because if there's an abort for any reason, Dream Chase will